time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations stitched together, one story at a time. My name's Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X-Stitch, and this week I am talking with Deborah Simon, an extraordinary sculptor and embroiderer based in Brooklyn. Deborah's work combines faux fur, sculpted foam, and anatomical artistry in ways that are beautiful, unsettling, and completely unforgettable. In this first part of our exchange, we get into her art school days, her love of the outdoors, and how she ended up creating these haunting bears that sit somewhere between childhood teddy and trophy mount. I'm genuinely fascinated by how she weaves science and storytelling into each piece, and I've been a fan of Deborah since 2014, so it was great to finally chat with her. If you enjoy embroidery that has an anatomical slant, then you will love my conversation with Cass Janes. That's Needle Exchange 001. Who also stitches anatomy and cross sections. And if you feel like leaving a review for Needle Exchange, that would be wonderful. I got a lovely review the other day, and it's so rewarding to know that you appreciate what I'm doing. Gives me all the feels. Thank you so much. I'll be back next week with the second part of the conversation with Deborah. So until then, enjoy the show. One of the first questions I wanted to ask you, and it's something that, like, I use your work in presentations. Whenever I do them, I use your work in presentations because it's some of the best. I have this talk that I do that's called The View from the Cutting and Stitching Edge. I'm available for booking both nationally and internationally. Now, I do that, and I just show people all kinds of stuff, and it's one of those things that brings me joy because there's so much good stuff out there. And for some reason, because I stand up in front of a PowerPoint and I talk about it and show people things, it reflects very well on me, and yet I've done very little of the actual work. So I'm always very happy with it. So I always have you walk up there, right? And I have this kind of standard bit, because I think in some ways when I do a presentation, it is a bit like stand-up comedy, because that's the kind of person I am. But the thing I always say, I've got the picture of the brown bear. The brown bear sat down, and it's beautiful, it's poignant, and I go into all of that. And then the other question I have is, I wonder what she does with it when it's not being showed. Does she make an occasional table out of it and then just rest a drink upon it? And so that was honestly, as daft as it sounds, that's one of my first questions is, you make these amazing pieces of work. Where do you keep them? What do you do with them?
Well, I mean, if you want, I can change the angle on this because they're... Some of them are just sitting right there.
Now, this is an audio podcast, so people will just have to imagine, but it's quite the, it's almost like I'm looking at something from Pan's Labyrinth going on in the background. I'm not going to lie.
Well, that's the painting in the background's actually, it's a Photoshop painting. And I had it printed on wood panel and then did some more painting on it. And then the sculpture is, it's for those of you who cannot see it, it's a Sitka deer head. It's based on the Amur River ecosystem. So it's a Sitka deer with wood mice, red squirrel, and the little owl kind of living on branches and roots that are coming out of the head. I'm actually working, which it's not up at the moment, but I'm working on a life-size Siberian tiger. And the deer head had started out inside the tiger, and it just wasn't working. So it's kind of spun off into its own piece.
I absolutely love your work since the moment I saw it, right? And I remember the first time I ever saw some of the pieces because, and I'll get you to describe the work in a second, but, you know, the polar bears in particular, well, just the bears, there's a real poignancy. And I remember writing a blog post about you, God, 2013, maybe, I'm not sure. Probably should have done my research, if I'm honest. Looking back and just like feeling the poignancy and often having to say to people, and I wrote it sort of saying, you have to remind yourself that these aren't actual animals that have been, you know, taken apart. You know, there's your model making is remarkable. So I just wanted to put that out there. Big fan. Can you tell everybody about your work, please?
Well, animals have always been part of my work. I mean, like, you know, my mother, like most moms, kept a lot of my drawings from, you know, like age four, and they're all cats, dogs, you know, it's all animals. And so I was always very interested in animals. And I stopped doing animals when I went to art school because, of course, that's not very cool. And of course, you want to be cool when you're in art school. Mm-hmm. And so after graduate school, I went back into working on animals. And I started sculpting them. I was living in India at the time, and it's a very sculpture-based society. And it was funny because I had been doing painting, and like everyone who walked into our apartment would look at the paintings and be kind of confused. And as soon as I started sculpting, it all made sense. So it was kind of cool being in a more three-dimensionally oriented society than our two-dimensional one. But I was just doing the animals with the sculpted heads and the fur, and it was boring. After a while, I was just like, these are not working. They're boring. And I realized that I was very interested in the stage when I was making the pattern for the fur. Because I learned early on that if you're going to make a pattern for the faux fur to go over the body, it has to be labeled really carefully.
Right.
You take patterns off of, like, you know, because the bodies are foam. So I just pin the pattern pieces on and I think, oh, of course this will make sense when I take it off, and totally doesn't. So, you know, I would carefully label everything and mark it. And that kind of would end up looking like one of those butcher maps, you know, where it has the map, you know, the picture of the cow with all the different, you know, cuts labeled. And I thought, that's interesting. And so then I was thinking, like, okay, what if I did something like that, but my handwriting is just dreadful. And so I thought, well, maybe if I embroidered the names, that would slow me down and make my handwriting legible. But somehow it just, I never even did that. It just jumped to embroidering organ systems. And so then it just jumped to that. And I was actually very resistant to using embroidery in my artwork. And it was really that polar bear was the first piece. And I was really struggling with it. And at the time I had my studio at home, and I ran into my neighbor, and she's like, I don't know what you're working on in there. I can see it through the window, but she's like, it's really good. So I was like, oh, okay, this must be working.
It's fascinating. I love it. I love, because you can just tell, because of the work that you do, you can tell it's one of those, this is what you had to do. And I just love the nonchalance with which you've gone, well, the writing wasn't very good, so I went, nervous system. Just, you know.
I don't remember how I made that jump. It just did. It went from, how am I going to make my handwriting legible, to let's do blood vessels.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, and I'm kind of going to jump around because I wanted to talk about this a bit later, but my first needle exchange was with Kath Janes, and she does a lot of anatomical embroidery. She does cross sections of things and all that kind of thing. And you're in a similar realm because there's quite, like, I feel like you respect the science in the work that you do.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in science. I was one of those kids that was a real dinosaur geek, you know, who could go on forever and list all the Latin binomials of dinosaurs and animals and could bore you to death with, like, facts about orcas and things like that. I can still do that.
I think you might need to meet my daughter, Flora. She's exactly the same. I'm quite, great role model here.
Yeah, I mean, to this day, I mean, my favorite museums are natural history museums. Any time we travel, you know, the Natural History Museum is on the top of the list, you know, even more so than the art museums. And so for me, it's kind of a struggle because I'm so anal about being accurate. Like, my wildest dream is for a biologist to come in and be like, that's such a Sika deer. You know, like, they could actually get, you know, like, even the subspecies, that's the Manchurian subspecies, you know? And so, and it's, you know, and I worked for many years through school at veterinary clinics, and surgery was always my favorite part of the job. I mean, assisting in surgery, I wasn't responsible for anything other than like handing a clamp. But so anatomy has always been something that I've been interested in and focused on. And I don't know, maybe it's the kind of like how things work interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's, yeah. But and that's the thing with, say, with Kath, saying that we talked about, you know, the old scientific illustrations and stuff, because you have the opportunity to appreciate the beauty of this stuff, the way we're put together, and not take it for granted. Like, you can see it.
Well, one of the very cool things here in New York is there is, I'm blanking on the name. It's some sort of like historical medical society on the Upper East Side, you know, in like one of those gorgeous old brownstones facing Central Park. And they have a medical library, and they have books that go back to ancient Rome. So like I could go in there and like have them pull a book from the 1200s for me, and they would just let me sit there and go through it.
Is that like the Academy of Medicine?
Yes, that is it. That is the Academy of Medicine. Yes, that is it. And they have a library, and, you know, and the librarian was lovely. And I told her, because, you know, you look at the, she said, well, what book do you want to look at? And like, you know, the titles are so nondescriptive, you know, it's, you know, anatomy in Latin, you know, for 300 years and all the books. And I, so I sort of described to her what I was looking for. And she pulled out just the most amazing books from the 15th through the 1800s. And that was a lot of, you know, I'm sure that was a huge help. I mean, that's kind of the stuff that just gets stuck in my brain subconsciously and comes spewing out later.
Because we take that stuff for granted, I guess, don't we? We take so much for granted, but I guess we're taking accurate scalpels for granted, or, you know, microscopes and those kind of things. What can you tell me about 15th century anatomy that I can use to sound really smart at a dinner party?
Actually, a lot of it wasn't that far off. I mean, you know, I guess it depends. You know, for me, what I found interesting wasn't so much the funky stuff, you know, like the belief in humors and, you know, all of the rest of the oddball stuff based on the ancient Greeks, but was the way that they organized the drawings.
Okay.
You know, so that you could look at these systems, which were obviously based on dissection and, or, you know, in the case of animals, butchering meat. And so in some respects, like, you know, they knew what the heart looked like, and they knew where all the major blood vessels went, and the liver and the kidneys. But for me, it was this sort of the decision-making to organize it all visually as a reference material, which I find fascinating.
Hmm. So tell me more, because I don't know. You're going to have to now. We're on a path.
Well, it's more of like, you know, it's a way of isolating the systems. You know, or, you know, a lot of times you would have the body, you know, this dissected open body with like the torso cut open. And then, you know, like the nervous system would be coming out of it, and you'd have this pattern of nerves. And then sometimes there'd be like little side sections, you know, with, you know, what the nerves led to, but it was all done in this beautifully composed page. That, you know, you would sort of look at it. And that would always be for me when I'm working with the embroidery is, you know, how do I organize the information? You know, because, you know, obviously I can't be super realistic about it. And, you know, it's that interesting thing. I don't know if you remember, oh God, it must have been, I don't know how long ago it was, but the bodies exhibition.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so I remember looking at that and, you know, having that kind of squeamish feeling of like, you know, did these people really volunteer for this procedure? but then also looking at, you know, like the lungs, they had this one where they had all the blood vessels of the lungs right down to all the capillaries. And it just became this beautiful but massive block of red. You know, and so you look at that and you think like, okay, visually, as cool as it is, but how do you do that in embroidery?
Yeah.
So it's those sort of, I think that was what helped me the most with those drawings, was making, taking all the information and making compositional decisions.
Because I guess when you think about, like, if I think about the illustrations you might see in textbooks, I guess sometimes it's almost like you just see the nervous system floating of its own accord, isn't it? And it's not like you could really unpick that from a human. So I'm guessing back in the day, like you say, when they're representing all this work, it's almost like they're unpeeling a person and drawing what they see, because that's probably about as good as it gets.
And I think that, you know, and he's pulling it out of the body. So I don't know. It makes me always wonder, like, how they did it. You know, like, were they pulling these things out of the body and they're sort of like still attached into the torso, but yet they've got this thing that's lying off to the side and that's what they're drawing. And then just, you know, nowadays we would just take a photo. Like, you would never have to sit down, you know, and plus you would have to work quickly, because in most European countries at the time, you were allowed, I think, one day a year with to dissect a human being. It was usually someone who was a prisoner who'd been hung or decapitated or whatever. And, you know, and the church would be there and it would be this one sanctioned day to violate a corpse.
Was it, could it have been any day, or was it like this 13th of June, everybody, corpse violation day?
Particular day, and I have no idea, like, if that varied from place to place or if...
just everybody did it same day.
Yeah, because I know, you know, in the Renaissance, you know, Michelangelo and Leonardo, you know, most people think that they snuck in.
Right.
And dissected corpses, because it was pretty illegal.
Mm.
You know, and when you look at... you know, like, I don't know what the laws in England were, but, you know, people like Hook and, God, who else am I thinking of? You know, there were a bunch of people who did experimentations with circulation and how the heart worked.
Right.
I think Hook was the primary guy in England. But, you know, they were doing things that were fairly illegal.
We can get away with it now.
Yeah, no, so... you know, you had to work fast. Like, if you know, and plus also, you know, there's no refrigeration. So, I mean, there must have been a point where you just couldn't take it anymore.
It'd get a bit funky, wouldn't it? Yeah. And I've read comics for years, and I often think there's certain, and I see this in your work as well. You know, I've seen, sounds grim when I say it out loud, but I've seen comics where people's skin has been flayed, and, you know, it's always like a magical death ending thingamabob, and it's kind of akin to that, isn't it? There's this like pagan witchcraft vibe thing going on all the time. And I sort of, this is what fascinates me about your work, is somewhere it's like it's scientific and it's magical to me. It kind of sits in both worlds. I don't know if that's an intention or that's just my interpretation of it.
No, I mean, I guess I haven't really thought about that, but I'm not a big comic book reader, but I'm a huge sci-fi fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm aware of that.
So there is that in there. And, you know, I also just, at a very basic level, I want it to be beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like that the object is actually beautiful is important to me.
Mm. Yeah, and that's it. And I think that's where the otherworldliness of it, the way you present these pieces, you know, like particularly when it is things like veins and nerves and they're floating in the air. And I think that's, to me, the mysticality of it. You could almost imagine someone having that image within some kind of story where something kind of really, I don't know what I'm thinking of, like wood gods and all those kind of things. It feels like there could be something in there. Because you do, you present it sometimes, like that piece that you've got up with the panda in the woods there, it reminds me, do you know Michelle Kingdom?
I love her work. Yeah, I've been in shows with her. I've never met her, but I just am such a big fan of her work.
She probably lives around the corner from you or something ridiculous. You Brooklyn.
It's funny. Every once in a while, like, I'll show with somebody and I'll realize they're like five blocks from me.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I could go and walk around Brooklyn and spend about a fortnight just saying hello to people in three streets. I mean, I don't know, but it feels like that. Very.
Yes.
But there's she has a similar thing. Her work is obviously like human forms, but the plant life and the colors that she chooses and stuff like that, there's that kind of mysticism, there's that otherworldliness in there as well. It feels like you two are good bedfellows.
I'd be honored to be with her.
Which pieces did you start doing first then? Because I was looking, yeah, so 2014 was when I wrote about you.
Well, I started with the polar bear.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one was the brown bear, the grizzly, which I really struggled with. And that was when I learned to really back up and build maquettes and paint out my compositions. And so then I did the two black bears. And at that point, I had run through all of the North American bears. And I was also a little sick of bears, so I moved on to rabbits.
From one cartoon favorite to another.
Well, that was actually one of the things that interested me, because bears, like the original, you know, one of the things I originally liked about them is that they're sort of the quintessential stuffed animal.
Mm.
You know, both not only as the iconic hunting trophy. I mean, I don't know if you've traveled through the American West, but you can't go very many places without seeing, you know, a stuffed bear, or I mean, deer heads actually. And, you know, pronghorn heads. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, you just see them, you know, like at the Natural History Museum here in New York, one of the curators told me that they have an enormous collection of gigantic bears, that if you wanted to actually study the morphology of bears, theirs is not a good collection, because so many donors would go out, shoot a gigantic bear, give them $1 million and say, here, have this bear. And they would be like, oh, thank you.
Thank you.
We really need another gigantic Kodiak. So, but they're also your, you know, the childhood toy.
Mm.
I mean, we all had teddy bears. And, you know, they become your best friend, your safety, the person, you know, the one object you whisper your fears and your secrets to and show all your vulnerabilities to. And, you know, and I also find it kind of funny that during the Victorian era, just as, you know, there's still the wilderness in America, but so much of America has become tamed in a sense. You know, it's definitely, you know, we've gone coast to coast. And you have the romantic movement through the Victorian era, you know, coming out of Europe, where, you know, nature is being glorified. Everybody's aghast at the Industrial Revolution and what's happening to the wild spaces. And you take this animal that can easily kill people and did so probably on a regular basis. And, you take off the fangs, you take out the teeth, and you stick it in the nursery.
Mm.
I mean, it's kind of an odd thing to do. It's one thing like to stick a bunny in there,
mm.
or like a dog or a cat, but you take a bear.
Yeah. Alligators never quite got the same treatment, did
no,
they?
No. And I mean, and then also, you know, you've got the whole charismatic megafauna, you know, in conservation, you know, things like pandas, tigers, jaguars, leopards, bears, they're all referred to as charismatic megafauna because they're the big bucks, you know, like nobody's going to pay a ton of money to save an obscure newt, you know, where jaguars live. That's even more endangered than the jaguar, but they will pay a lot of money for a big, beautiful, awe-inspiring cat who also have, because when you're dealing with animals that big, you know, they live in enormous spaces. So you help, it helps to preserve everything that comes underneath, you know, in that ecosystem. So that was another interest with the bears, you know, is how people think about them. How do you relate to them?
Mm. I've just written down charismatic megafauna. It sounds like a great album title. Band name or something, isn't it?
We had, when I worked at the zoo, we had a list of like great band titles on the fridge.
We've got one with my daughters. We went to this field one day near where their grandma lives and there were loads of buttercups. And the next day they were all gone. And we said there'd been a buttercup annihilation. I was like, that's a good band name.
That is. Yeah. We had, my big contribution was Komodo Dragon Death Trap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That would be, that probably hurt my ears to listen to that kind of tune, I think. So you started out with a bear. So I'm going to spin back a little bit then. So your background, you studied art Hang on. This was one that got me. You studied at the Repin Institute of Art in Leningrad.
Yeah.
Studying sculpture. That doesn't come up very often. Yeah.
It was a semester abroad. Well, I was at the San Francisco Art Institute, and our semester abroad, the only requirement was that I went, I think, 250 miles away from school.
She went, I know.
Yeah. Nobody seemed to care what happened after that. and I had been interested in going to Russia. Don't ask me. To this day, I don't really quite know. I mean, my family was originally from there. We knew very little about them. So there was some interest. And I think, you know, I was kind of a hyper realist in a conceptual school.
Okay.
So I, you know, there's a part of me, I think, that had this romanticized version of the academic salon style school that Russia still taught,
mm-hmm.
which was not as much fun as it was in my brain, but but I did learn a lot. And so I was looking into going, and the school had heard from, I said, what is it? In Tbilisi, the Lenin School of Monumental Sculpture.
That sounds cool.
Well, at the time I was like, you know, I don't speak any Georgian. You know, I've been studying Russian, and I wasn't really sure I wanted to do monumental, like Stalinist, Leninist style sculpture. And then right when we were kind of debating like how to respond, a student came through from the Repin Institute who was seeking asylum in the States. And he put me in touch with his professor, and somehow, to this day, I'm really not still sure, because I was always semi-officially there. I wasn't officially invited by the school, but I was sort of allowed in, and I didn't realize it at the time. And so somehow it all worked, and I ended up, you know, living in the Soviet Union for about 9 months. And just by sheer dumb luck, I left 2 weeks before it collapsed.
Wow.
Yeah, my mother met me in Leningrad, and my mother's background, her family's from Scotland. So she met me in Leningrad and went to Edinburgh and then went up into the Highlands where the family was originally from. And so I don't know, some B&B watching the news one night, and there's Yeltsin standing on the tank waving a flag.
yeah, that's crazy. Do you think the bears, is there a Russian thing in there, or is that just a coinkidink?
I think it's a coincidence, because I mean, you know, we camped a lot when I was a child. And so, you know, I'd been looking at bears and thinking about not having bears eat our food and come into our campsite since I was a little kid. So bears had been there for a long time.
So is it sculpture? So when you're at San Francisco, you went in to study sculpture. Is that the?
Yeah. Well, San Francisco, I started out in both painting and sculpture.
Right.
And then very quickly just became sculpture. And started actually in ceramics, which upon the move to New York became horribly impractical. And and then I was doing a mix of sculpture and painting. And after I got out of grad school, it kind of went just painting for a while. And it really took being in India to kick me back in to fully sculpting. But I do both. And actually at the moment, the embroidery is kind of going back to being like a straight, flat, two-dimensional embroidery. And the sculpture is having some textile work in it, but not very much embroidery in it.
Hmm. And then, and are you at peace? You seem like someone, like I said earlier, who like, you go with your flow, like you don't overthink it. You just accept the way you're feeling and you move in those directions. Is that reasonable?
Oh, no, I totally overthink it.
Do you? Okay. Good show. Just like, write down pros and cons of every step you take.
Yeah, no, I generally, because it takes me, I'd say it takes me at least a year to generally make a piece.
Right.
Or, you know, 6 months to a year, depending on the size.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think about it for months.
Okay.
And if it stays with me that long, then I know that it has the staying power for me to stick with it all that time.
Do ideas come to you while you're finishing another piece? Does that thing happen?
you know, when you've got an idea and you're like, pretty much that one's going the way I want, so another idea's got a bit of space to creep in.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, usually I like that when that happens. I can also like tell, you know, especially it happens when I can tell that this is going to be the last piece in the series. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I was working on The Last Bear, I was kind of like, all right, this feels like I've said all I need to say with this. You know, it's time to move on to something else. Mm. And then I'm really like the most miserable human being when that doesn't happen and I'm done with the piece and there's nothing in my brain for what's next except lots of bad ideas that I know aren't going anywhere.
So what do you do then? Do you just go and cook some food for a month? I
mean, oh God, I'm a terrible cook. My husband cooks.
Okay. God.
No, I just generally make myself miserable. I make, you know, I whine and complain to him and sulk around, think it's the end of the world.
Does that happen often, or do you find that actually, I mean, maybe at the end of an opus, perhaps there is that what the next opus is going to be. I'd imagine when you're in the middle of a series, it must be a bit quicker.
I'm happiest when I'm in the middle of something. Like when I feel like it's an idea and it's working and I'm moving along and working, that's like my happy spot. Mm. And then sometimes the beginning of things, like playing around, you know, I tend to do a lot of sketches and build a lot of models and, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm. So I do a lot of planning and samples.
And are you using techniques there that then you studied when you did study sculpture? Like, I don't know anything about sculpting. I mean, I can do maybe a bit of clay modeling, make a pot with my daughter. So imagine I've got still no idea how you make your bears. What kind of process do you go through? And is that akin? Have you evolved in a certain direction with your technique?
Yeah. I mean, like for the bears, that came out of, I was sculpting the bodies in foam. Mm-hmm. So, and then the bodies would become like a dressmaker dummy so that I could pin the pattern to them. And I, you know, would do the pattern in, you know, muslin, you know, fit it, mark it, cut it up, and then sew that in fur, or in the embroidered case, it would be in linen. And it would be kind of like a onesie that would come off that I can put it into an embroidery hoop. And then the head and the paws were sculpted out of like a polymer clay that I could bake in the oven.
Right.
Like Sculpey. I don't know if you guys have that.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
And that was mostly because I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't really figure out how to make the faces furry and get like the expression and the details that I wanted without actually sculpting it, like to do it out of fur. And now, of course, you know, it's like you look on Instagram and there are all these people who do these crazy animal replicas using faux fur and painting it. And I've just never been able, I was at the time, I couldn't really figure out what I was doing. And now I'm just so kind of, you know, you get to a point where you do things in a certain way and it becomes your language. But then there's a part of me that wonders if it also becomes a crutch, you know, that goes into part of my thinking in the beginning, you know, like, am I doing this because it's comfortable or am I doing this because it's an integral part of the piece and conceptually necessary?
Is that not like an opera singer who trains their voice to sing a certain style of opera? And maybe in their minds, they think, well, I could be singing, I don't know, country and Western music or something, but their voice is designed to go a certain direction. You know, I'd imagine your evolution is in the content and in the stories that you're telling. The medium of your storytelling might just be, that's the medium, that's the Deborah Simon way of doing things, you know?
Yeah, there's that. But that's part of my overthinking in the beginning, probably, is where I pick things apart, you know, like I'll have the idea and I'll let the idea sort of freeform balloon in my head. And then it goes through two stages. I will build the model and think, oh, that's not physically possible, what's in my brain. And you would think after all these years that I still wouldn't do that, but I do that all the time. And I'll be like, oh, I can't do that. I don't know how to make that work. You know, gravity. So then I would end up sitting down and looking at it and thinking like, well, is this necessary? You know, what works, you know, overall for the whole. So in a sense, you know, for me, it's whatever material works. And if that's casting in urethane, then I'll do that. If it's using fabric, if it's embroidering, if it's, you know, sculpting with epoxy, then, you know, those are the mediums that I'll choose. And I'll often, you know, like I was trying to figure out how to bead the deer antlers, which in the end I didn't end up doing, but I did a bunch of samples where I would bead on a silk organza and then try to use an epoxy to epoxy the organza to the antlers without having the beads be covered by epoxy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll just start experimenting with different things until I find something that works.
And is your experimentation done before you then dive into the project that becomes the final piece? Like, do you get it all out? Because I know, you know, it's quite easy. Some people go with the flow, can revise their own work. I've spoken to people like Kaz Holmes, you know, who'll do a piece. And if that bit goes wrong, you can kind of cut it out and you can bodge a bit over the top because that's the nature of her work. Are you more procedural than that?
I'm a both, you know, like deer antlers, on the piece hanging in the studio, you know, I've busted those, I don't know, 5 or 6 times and rebent them and resculpted them. So I will do that. But something like if I were going to, I was thinking about beading blood vessels,
mm-hmm,
and having them snake around the antlers. And so that's the kind of thing where if I'm going to do all that beading and then epoxy them to the antlers, I don't really want to undo that. And it's hard to undo. I mean, I'm really faced with just starting over at that point. So that's where I will definitely back up and do a lot of tests and figure out what works. You know, like if in my studio, I'll just have samples, mm-hmm, hanging everywhere of, you know, and like that's one experiment that I might use, but in the end I decided it wasn't necessary. But I did spend probably 2 months doing samples.
That's nice. That's nice, isn't it? And then are you, with your overthinking, are you able to go, all right, I'm done? Does that come easily, going, I think I've finished?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I'm not one of those people, like, when it's done, it's done. I don't go back into it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather think to myself, like, oh, that's done. It didn't work. I'm moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't ever tend to go back into pieces.